This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there's a lot of misinformation out there about autism, from myths about vaccines to misconceptions about who's affected by autism. Our next guest is a reporter who's on the autism spectrum himself. In his new book, he shares stories from people around the country and tackles some of those myths and misconceptions. And he says we need to rethink the autism conversation and move from talking about cures and treatments to finding better ways to include people at work, at school, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you autistic? Or is someone in your family, one of your loved ones, autistic? What do you think people get wrong about it? What are ways that society is not built for people with autism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Michael Garcia is a senior D.C. correspondent for The Independent. He's the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about what led you as a reporter, a journalist with autism to tackle this book and talk to people around the country to share their stories?
Sure. So first off, I was born. I was born autistic. That's an old joke for you. The second thing that happened was that I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 23. I moved to be an economics and politics journalist. I always wanted to be that. Didn't think I'd ever be anything more than that. Then I was at a party one night with a friend by the name of Tim Mack. And he offered me a drink. And I said, I don't drink because I'm on the autism spectrum. And I don't. And a medicine I take doesn't mix with alcohol. And he's like, oh, there's a lot of autistic people in Washington, D.C. in politics, in law, in journalism, and things like that. He's like, you should write something about that. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe one day. But then when I was at National Journal and then they were shutting down the print magazine, I pitched that article to my editor. And he's like, well, why should this exist? And he's like, well, I said, well, I think we focus too much on trying to cure autistic people, not enough on trying to help them live fulfilling lives. He's like, there's your piece right there. And then, so I wrote that piece. That broke big. And then my next question was, well, what would that look like? And you have to remember, around this time in 2015, I grew up in Southern California. There was a big measles outbreak at Disneyland, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, and like those people, I mean, those are a bunch of hippies in California. And at the same time, Donald Trump was running for president, and he was saying that autism has become an epidemic. He blamed vaccines, just saying a lot of things that were just not true. So my feeling was, somewhere along the line, we've gotten a lot wrong about autism. And as a political journalist, my feeling is, okay, if we're getting things wrong about autism, that must mean that what we do to help, quote unquote, help autistic people must be really bad too. So I hit the road. And I, you know, I'm a political journalist at heart, so I decided to hit the road and see how are we failing autistic people, but more importantly, what could be done to make things better for autistic people?
And a recurring theme in your book, I mean, it's in the title, you just mentioned it all throughout the book, this idea that we're not broken, you're not broken, and moving the conversation from how do we prevent autism, cure autism, fix autism, whatever, to how do we change society so that we include people with different neurodiversity, I think is the phrase often used.
Different neurodivergent, you know. So the stat I always give is that of the $364 million the United States spends, both with nonprofits and with the federal government, spends on autism research, and this is from 2016, only about 2% of that goes toward lifespan issues. By comparison, about 35% of autism spending research goes on biology, and about 24% goes on risk factors. So that's about half of our research budget goes to what causes autism, and then, you know, what are risk factors. And then on top of that, there are treatments. So that's a large part of it. And then we're not really spending that much on what happens to autistic people as they grow up. What are the difficulties that they face? What are the difficulties as they want to go to school, or if they don't want, if they can't go to school, or if they can work, or if they can't work? What's the problems facing unemployment? So to me, that seemed like a big problem, because it seemed like for a long time, we were focusing on what parents or what researchers or what clinicians or professors wanted, and less on what can we actually do for the people right here and right now. You know, even if you were to create a cure, that's not going to help autistic people who you have right now.
One other misconception you look at is who people think of as autistic. And I think the image that I'll admit usually would pop into my mind, and I think for a lot of people, is they're young, they're white, and they're male. And that is not accurate at all, right?
Right. I mean, like the classic example is if you look at shows like The Good Doctor or what's the other one? Atypical, or even going back to shows like or movies like Rain Man, the archetype of an autistic person is typically a young, typically adolescent or teenage white male, sometimes older. And if you look at covers like Time and Newsweek, I went back and I looked at a lot of covers of Time magazine, and it was like young, you know, blonde haired adolescent boys. But like, A, that excludes a lot of adults. B, that excludes a lot of women and girls, and see that really excludes a lot of people of color. And it goes back to my point that in the original study about autism in 1943, the first widely read study about autism in 1943, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact by Leo Connor, none of the children were people of color. Only 3 of them were girls. 9 of them were from Anglo-Saxon families, and the other 2 were Jewish. And as a result, we kind of still have that idea of those are the type of people who can be autistic.
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. Quote, Eric, that struck me in your book is from John Elder Robison, an autistic author and advocate. I'm quoting him now, as you quoted in your book, "Our duty in autism is not to cure, but to relieve suffering and to maximize each person's potential." Can you talk about that mindset as a starting point?
Certainly. I think that a lot of people say that we talk about not curing autism. We're saying that autism is all rainbows and butterflies, or it's not a disability. Autism is a disability. I will say that from the rooftops. But what we should do is we should work to fix the impairments, or work to help autistic people with their impairments. And then we should also work to maximize their potential. And just like how deaf people don't want to be cured, or blind people don't want to be cured, we wouldn't want to cure people with Down syndrome. We should work to improve the lives of autistic people, get rid of the impairments, but then also find ways to make the world more adaptable to them, and find ways to make the world better for them. So a statistic that I cite, and we don't even really know, is that autistic people, around 85% of autistic young adults we know, deal with unemployment. That's a big social problem. We should look at what does it take to help autistic people find work and make sure that they have good jobs if they want to work or if they can work. What does it take, and how can we facilitate that more than just, oh, we should try to fix them, you know?
You give an example from your own career, your academic career at community college, then at the University of North Carolina, about accommodations for you that you were initially reluctant to ask about.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of autistic people and a lot of disabled people as a whole, especially when you go to university, you've already gone through a special education system at one point or another, and you've seen how often it usually doesn't help, or it's segregating and it's isolating, or you get treated, or because kids can be so cruel, they see that it puts a mark on your back, or there's a lot of other things. So a lot of times we just don't want to talk about it. And then also we're afraid that we're going to be seen as getting special treatment. It's why I'm not a fan of the term special needs. But those accommodations are there, and they're there for a reason, and they matter. And I think that a lot of times we have to overcome our ableism, our internalized ableism, and the thoughts that, you know, we're told from the beginning of our lives that we're a problem. And we need to recognize that those services are there for a reason. And I think on top of that, we're also kind of told that, well, if you're at university, you must not be really disabled, right? Which is like such a terrible thing to say, because it says that only certain types of people can go to university. It says that you can't go to university if you're disabled. What we should do is we should say that, you know, you're here for a reason. These accommodations are here to help you, are here to help you. And we should not fear them, you know?
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia, senior DC correspondent for The Independent. He's talking to us about his new book. It's called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have experience with autism yourself? If you're willing to share the story of when you first found out about a diagnosis, maybe it's somebody in your family. Or do you have a question for our guest about the conversations he had with people around the country, the different accommodations he found out about along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a new service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday morning at 11 on the Ideas Network.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with autism yourself or with a loved one, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric, as part of your work on this book, you talked to people who need more care in their everyday lives, who, for example,
yes,
maybe university may not be an option, who had experiences different than your own. What kind of things did you learn from them?
Yeah, they were, it was really important for me to include autistic people who have higher support needs, or maybe who can't speak. And it was important for me to say that because, or maybe university might not be an option for them. And it was important for me because I wanted to show that they could have a good life and that it's possible to have a good life. Because I think a lot of times people say, and I knew the response to this book would be, oh, it's easy for you to say because you are quote unquote high functioning, even though I'm not a fan of that term, and you are successful, you have a job, things like that. But what about my kid? So I wanted to include people who are, A, I believe that I have a lot more in common with your kid than you realize. B, I wanted to include people like these kids and like your child. And I wanted to show that it was possible to live a good and happy life. And the way we do that is by having a support system around you, a support system around these people, and B, that we that it requires spending and it requires prioritization of these things. And it requires that we prioritize ensuring that these people have home and community-based services so that they can live in the community, that these are actual home and community-based services, that they're not just de facto institutions like they often have been. Or we wanted to, you know, I wanted to show that it's possible for them that they should have, you know, home care workers who care about them and take them seriously and take their medical needs seriously. I wanted to make sure that if they have intellectual disabilities, they aren't exploited in workshops, segregated workshops, or paid below the minimum wage, which is completely legal, and people don't realize that. So it was really important for me to include their voices as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking this call. My question is regarding, first of all, Eric, you're a brilliant guy, and kudos to you for doing what you do.
Thank you.
I have met a young man who's 24 years old. He's very affected by autism. He is not able to live by himself. He goes to a day program, but he says to me, I am not autistic. I have autism. And I'm wondering, I hear you referring to autistic people, and I'm wondering which you prefer.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
So,
yeah, go ahead, Eric.
That is a good question. That is a really good question. The thing that I did when I was traveling around, I made sure to ask, was I was really keen to ask people, do you prefer to use what's called person first language or identity first language? Person first language is, I believe, what this gentleman is referring to himself as. I have autism, and then I tend to say that I'm autistic. And it's everybody's personal preference, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to refer to themselves. But B, I think the change comes because for a long time, parents of autistic people wanted to make sure that their children weren't defined by their disability, or they were afraid that if they were called autistic, that it would lead to stigma. I think a younger generation, even though this young man, I think, is younger than I am, he's 24 and I'm 30 years old. A lot of younger autistic people, and I guess people who have understood themselves more, see that autism is inextricable from who they are. That a lot of people say, see the person, not the disability, or don't let your disability define you. No, like, I really need you to see my disability, and I need you to see other autistic people's disability, and I need you to see that A, that doesn't make them less, but B, that it is an intrinsic part to who they are. So I think that there's a divide, but again, I think that it really depends on how that person sees themselves. And again, I wouldn't tell this young man how to, I'm feeling old now, but I wouldn't tell this young man how to see himself, but more than anything, I'm curious why he sees that as important, why that distinction is important, because it's a distinction we all take and we all carry with each other. So.
Thanks a lot for the call and the question, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia. His new book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Kenosha. Michelle, hi.
Hi
Michelle.
Hi, love this conversation. I have an uncle who was born in 1935 and wasn't diagnosed with autism until about 10 years ago. What I find interesting is, you know, that's just who he was. So our family had to deal with that. But he did have a successful life as a cabinet refinisher. He's extremely good with wood. But one thing I picked up on that you were talking about is how to deal with how to address needs as people get older, because now that he's in his 80s, it's been a challenge because he feels pain differently. And so my cousins and I have to work with the medical professionals so that they understand, like, if he starts doing this grunting or screaming, he's in pain, but he doesn't know how to communicate that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has been important for us to be translators for him. And it's interesting because, you know, on his own, it's like nobody listens. But if we help translate, then all of a sudden the doctor's like, oh, that's right. And then he gets treated and it solves the problem.
Michelle, thanks for that call. Eric, go for it.
That is really good. First off, that reminds me a lot of this woman and her mother I profiled in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by the name of Lil Wayman, and her mother, Brookie. That, like, a lot of people didn't take Lydia seriously, but they took her mom seriously, so that when they go to the hospital, like, her mom goes with her. And that was really important because, like, she recognized that, like, and in some ways she could be an advocate for her. And then now Lydia can speak. So, you know, it's not, you know, she's not taken as unseriously as other people, even though there, I have some stories about, like, how people didn't think that she thought she was faking. But, like, that's really good that you recognize that him grunting or his screaming or things like that are him trying to communicate something. Because I think a lot of times when we focus on, is that when people see that see autistic people screaming or see them, you know, grunting or even hurting themselves, a lot of times we focus on the behavior, but we don't focus on what actually is causing it. So A, that's really good. But B, you know, to my point, that's really why I wanted to write this book, because we really don't know a lot of things. I can't really, as much as I would like to give you a good answer, I don't think I could give you a good one, because we haven't, again, we only spend about 2% in 2016. We only spent about 2% of all of our entire research budget looking at lifespan issues. And that's really tragic, because autism, and I think about it too, because eventually I'm going to get old. I'm going to be like, you know, your uncle. And I don't know what, I don't know what's going to happen. And that's a really tough question. I don't really know. I wish I had a better answer, but I don't. I'm sorry.
Thanks for that call. And Eric, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Michael Garcia. He's a senior DC correspondent for The Independent, longtime political correspondent. He joined us for a look at his book today. It's called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. If you have a story to share with us, there's still time. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up after the news, TV game shows like Jeopardy and The Price is Right are being honored as an important piece of American entertainment history in a new archive. We'll learn more and ask you to share your favorite game shows of all time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the Biden administration is looking to crack down on gun dealers who don't follow the law as part of a wider effort to reduce gun violence. Get the details of the new plan tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, announced it will be the home of a new National Archives of Game Show History, the first of its kind. They hope to honor all the people who have shaped the industry from over the years, from big names like Vanna White from Wheel of Fortune to behind-the-scenes stories from producers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show of all time? Do you enjoy game shows or have some memories of watching them? Were you ever a participant on a game show? Love to hear what that was like, or part of a studio audience. Do you think they're an important part of our entertainment culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Bench is chief curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester. We started a conversation with him earlier this month. Had some technical issues, or whammies, if you will, on our end. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Great being here.
Well, remind us, we talked to you just briefly before, remind us why we want to pay attention here to game shows as part of our pop culture history.
Well, I think the competition right now for the replacement host on Jeopardy makes clear that loads of people care about game shows, about their impact on popular culture, their impact on our lives, and that it's essential that we preserve this form in a way that hadn't been attended to before now.
Right. Can you talk about how maybe it's been overlooked so far? We don't have museums and archives tackling our game show history.
We don't. So I was thrilled about a year ago when two veteran producers of game shows came to us and said, we're missing out. Our legendary performers, our back of the house sorts of professionals, lots of people are passing on. We're missing out on preserving their stories. They have been such a big part of American popular culture, really from the days of radio, almost a century of game shows. And today, they are more present than ever before. More nighttime hours of broadcast television are devoted to game shows than even at what we consider the peak. And I bet loads of your listeners are current watchers or have heritages of their favorites from days gone by.
And if you're listening and you do have a favorite, you can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your favorite game show? Do you have a favorite host? Have you ever been to one? Call 800-642-1234 as we talk to Chris Bench about a new National Archives of Game Show History. Chris, those stories you mentioned, that's going to be a focus, right? Can you talk about the sort of, oral histories you're hoping to collect?
That's right. We do want some of those front of the set kind of people, those hosts and hostesses, those announcers that we all think of when we think of our favorite shows. But we also want the multitude of people who go together to make these shows happen. Who could think of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire without the lighting designer who created that dramatic spotlight effect when people are answering questions, or the jingles and sounds, or the mechanical devices that turn clues on the screen, and those have moved into digital realms. So much, so many facets of craft and artistry and forethought to make these successful products.
Well, you mentioned Jeopardy. I want to give a listen to a moment from the long-running show, a bit of a funny moment from contestants Max and Kevin on the show, the category Most Populous Nation.
Populous Nation, 400.
Israel, Lebanon, Syria. Max.
What is Israel?
No. Kevin.
What is Syria?
Right.
Nation, 600.
Switzerland, Sweden, Swaziland. Max.
What is Switzerland?
No. Kevin.
What is Sweden?
Right.
Nation, 800.
Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia. Max.
What is Pakistan?
No. Kevin.
What is Indonesia?
Yes.
Most populous nation, 1,000.
Portugal, Colombia, Peru. Max.
What is Peru?
No. Kevin.
What is Colombia?
Right. Oh. No fun for Max, but a good run for
process of elimination there, I guess, Chris. And that, I mean, that also illustrated one of the things that I liked about Jeopardy. It's like bang, 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 question after question, not lots of chit chat in between. I don't know. Is that part of the appeal of why Jeopardy is such a standout among talk shows or game shows?
It is. And in fact, I was participating in a conversation with one of our co-founders, Bob Bowden, recently, who's produced so many shows. And his analysis of Jeopardy was the top level of questions, or I should say answers on the board, are ones that practically everyone can get. In between that and that bottom row, there are lots of ones that you can say, oh, I almost knew that, or you can shout out an answer. And that lowest row, the most difficult ones, are ones that you sort of say, wow, that's fascinating. I never knew that. So different ways for all the viewers to feel good about themselves as well as excited about shouting out those answers in their home, family room, or living room.
Now, getting back to the archive, you're not just interested in oral histories. You're also, I understand, hoping to get some stuff. What kind of physical artifacts are you on the hunt for?
We would love things called shell scripts. That's what the overall structure of a game show episode looks like, because it's very structured and thought out beforehand. I am currently getting tickets from game show studio audience members. I am waiting for the delivery of a category card from a winning participant on the $20,000 pyramid. So things that represent the studio audience, represent the contestants, represent the craft that goes into making these shows. All of those are things we hope to get. Plus those really showy items. We want the wheel from the Wheel of Fortune if we can get it, or the pyramid from Pyramid.
I know, I believe with your other exhibits at the Museum of Play, there are some hands-on and interactive things. Are you, Chris, going to host your own game show there?
I am looking forward to that. In fact, we have game show contestants on our staff here. Our archivist, Julia Novakovic, has been a contestant on Jeopardy, on Millionaire as well. So she can speak to what it's like being on the set. And we are hoping that everyone, when we get around in a few years to doing a game show exhibit, you'll feel like you are the contestant right there with the answers, meeting the challenges.
Now, of course, when I think game show, I think TV game show, Chris. But I think you've mentioned before to us that a lot of these started, this whole genre started on radio, which I want to hear more about. Are you looking to tap into that era as well?
That would be lovely. That's reaching a little bit back further into our history. So, but people transitioned from radio to television in so many ways, whether that was variety shows or comedy. And maybe there are a few long-term veterans who got their start in radio and have those memories to share with us today. I would love to get that continuity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Oleg is with us in La Crosse. Oleg, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
I want to tell you, I am a first-generation immigrant to America. My parents immigrated when I was 12 years old, and I remember the first game show that caught my attention was The Price is Right with Bob Barker as the host. You know, can't get much more classic than that. And I remember, you know, I was 12 years old, and my English wasn't even perfect yet. And by rights, what did I care about prices of consumer goods? But Bob Barker has had such an inimitable style and was such a great showman that I tuned in every day to this show, just to hear him, take people through this game of guessing prices of consumer goods.
Awesome. Oleg, thank you so much for sharing that story. I want to give a listen to The Price is Right. Contestants here guessing the price of a Honda Elite 80 motor scooter to get a chance to participate on stage.
And you get to bid on this first, Barbara.
$1,700.
$1,700, Michael.
Exactly, $2,148.
His bid is $2,148. That's an interesting bid. How did you settle on $2,148?
I seen that on there last week, and that was the exact price. I know that's what it is. I've seen it. I watch you every day. I watch you every day, Bob.
Well, Oleg and that contestant watched every day, Chris. And also we heard on Facebook from Brandy, who has memories of watching The Price is Right. Ah, and I remember doing this too, when Brandy was homesick as a kid. The Price is Right. Could you talk about where that stands as you're looking at the history of game shows?
You know, some of these shows are truly evergreen. They go on for decades, and people sort of pass them along as family traditions. Is this what you do while you watch, as you have dinner every night or before dinner or some kind of structure? So we really build so much of our behaviors around some of these shows that get incredible longevity and incredible loyalty from the audience.
Oleg, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your story. We are talking about game shows past and present with Chris Bench, chief curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Their new addition there, a TV game show history archive, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite game show past and present? Was it a routine for you to watch this show at this time every day? Have you ever watched Jeopardy at a bar with friends and strangers trying to beat each other to guess the answers? Do you have a game show that just didn't strike you as a very good one? Why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Support for WPR's Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. We're talking about game shows, their history, their new archive at that museum, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to hear your favorite game show or your favorite game show watching memory, or if you've ever been a part of a studio audience, you could share that experience too. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Darren when we asked about shows, Match Game. And Chris, that reminds me, there were a whole bunch of shows back in the 70s, I think in early 80s, that I remember watching as a kid, often what maybe while homesick from school. They often had B-list celebrities who I only knew because they were on, like Paul Lynde on Hollywood Squares. What are you looking for to tell the story of that era, of those shows that aren't with us anymore?
That is definitely something that taps into my personal memories. Yes, Hollywood Squares was one of my guilty pleasures when I was home with the flu and a little bright spot in the draggy day of drinking ginger ale and napping. So those kinds of things, yes, those B-list celebrities who took that niche on the television game shows and ran with it. And one of the things that I love is that so many of us wanted to be on those shows so much that we bought the board game version. There were so many of those out there. Password, Hollywood Squares, Jeopardy, Price is Right. All of those had game versions for the home audience, and you could play it around the card table and see whether you could do as well as the TV contestants.
Well, now knowing you as I do, Chris, I'm guessing that the Museum of Play already has some of those home games on hand, right?
We do. So I've been looking for those. We have them in tabletop versions. We also have them in their computer and video game versions. And we are looking for more. We don't have all of those. So I just told a donor that we would love about 50 of his personal games of that home consumer variety.
Well, if you have the home version of a famous game show, love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Still time for you to call in with your personal favorite game show of all time, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris, we're hearing from more people online than on the phone. Maybe that means something. I don't know, but we heard from James, who says the most interesting game show he ever watched was called Mastermind on the BBC when he was over there for a summer. He always thought PBS could try an American version of the show. I have never seen that. I know there have been a lot of game shows, including Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, that have moved from country to country.
There are, and Mastermind has a reputation amongst game show fans of being really brainy. And I can see why the PBS connection is there. And there was also a really successful, very popular home version of Mastermind. So that is an excellent one. Some of these are out there on streaming services, and some of them are also available for easy pickup on things like YouTube.
All right. Here's a, Chris, a philosophical question that I put way too much time into thinking about over the years. And it matters for your archive. When Survivor came out, right? People call it a reality TV show, but people were competing to win a prize at the end. It was Survivor, and are shows like that game shows that'll fit into your purview there?
That is such a perfect question, Rob. We were just having that conversation last week as we were defining some parameters. And the famous quote about pornography was, I know it when I see it. And sometimes game shows are what you believe them to be. Is it The Bachelor? You're winning a spouse, or any of those dimensions. They're on a sliding scale. It's even trickier with things like cooking shows, where you're showing off a skill, you're winning, you're competing. I am most inclined to think of the ones that your listeners are bringing up so far, the ones that have an established host, have a studio audience. Some of those, they're definitely the classic core definition of what a game show is, but it gets blurry, as you say, around the edges with cash prizes and winners and losers on loads of those reality shows.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Racine. Lynn, hi.
Hi. Yes, I've never been one to exercise on a regular basis. COVID and Drew Carey and The Price is Right, though, have got me into good shape. I exercise with Drew every morning at 10, with very few exceptions. So thanks to Drew and The Price is Right, he's my little guilty pleasure. That's my favorite game show.
Lynn, do you guess the prices? And do you ever guess the price correctly?
Not the price on the nose, but yeah, I play. And I've actually gone to see the live show, the traveling show. I've taken my mother and my son. So, I have done that.
Fantastic. So. Lynn, thank you so much for sharing that. So Lynn fits into her exercise routine. The Price is Right is, that's probably the right level of concentration for me. That makes a lot of sense, don't you think, Chris?
Yes, that's about my endurance capacity to do a half-hour game show. Perfect.
I love it, Lynn. Thanks for that. We'll go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, no whammies, and stop. Press your luck.
That, you know, it's funny, Marcus, because the big bucks, no whammies, that phrase sticks with me. I have to really think about which show it came from. That was Press Your Luck, you're saying?
Yeah, it was Press Your Luck. The other one I liked, though, was, stay home from school kind of sick day, was Hollywood Squares with Joan Rivers.
With Joan Rivers. Okay, Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Chris, Hollywood Squares is at that rotating cast. I know Paul Lynn was the center square. Joan Rivers was on it. Gilbert Gottfried was the center square for a long time. I don't know. It's providing a lot of work for celebrities over the years.
It did. And there were writers behind all of that. So they were sharp comedians, but they needed good content. And what we forget is they had lines and quips given to them, and they were scripts and jokes that we would love to capture and preserve for all time.
Marcus, thanks for a lot for that. And that reminded me, the catchphrases of, you know, is that your final answer? Big bucks, no whammies, Marcus just mentioned. Survey Says from Family Feud, which we haven't talked to. Those are ways that they've really crept into American pop culture, Chris.
That's part of our language. Everyone understands those structures and those phrases. So, yes, they are really integral to who we are today.
All right, Chris, I got to ask you the big question. Would you be good on Jeopardy? You know, in the moment, you're actually there in the studio. Do you think you could pull off a win?
I had a friend from graduate school who was on, and she was a smart woman, but she said her downfall was her buzzer skill. She wasn't hair trigger enough to actually press the button and get ahead of the other players. I worry that that would be my downfall.
All right. And do you have a favorite show of all time that you'd love to go back and watch and maybe feature prominently at the archive?
I was a pyramid guy growing up. And as the price range has escalated, I will date myself by saying I was watching when it was merely the $20,000 pyramid.
Excellent. Chris, thanks as always for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Rob. You're a winner.
You too. That's Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. He joined us to talk about the brand new archive they have there and the impact of game shows on American pop culture and entertainment history. You can still let us know your favorite game show of all time. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, scroll down a bit to find that conversation, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, just with the name of a game show that you love or loved in the past. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, lots of people in Wisconsin and around the country provide care to family members with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. We'll get advice, resources, and comfort for caregivers from the author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Last week on the show, we talked about postcards, their history, and why some people still love to send them. Here's some more of your stories from the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bill says, my wife mails them to our grandson who lives a mile away with bad riddles because he likes them. We're working down through a supply 50 years in the making. She also sends weekly support to ailing friends. We may have to travel again in order to reload. And Matthew says, I used to buy them instead of taking a picture because it was cheaper. I've been sending them to relatives now to relieve the isolation caused by the pandemic, and they're a great source of genealogy information. I just recently digitized several hundred family postcards using a scanner that scans the front and back of the postcard, a stack at a time, around 10 per minute. You can keep sharing your postcard memories and stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.